calcifying animal blood in a crucible, boiling lye with iron sulfate, carefully dripping acid into the mix. Suddenly, a flash of blue appears, deep Prussian blue. Almost like magic, a new colorant is born, a jealously guarded secret that changes the course of art history and makes its way to China, where it is used to create two beautiful maps. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. In this podcast, we hear from those who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. It's the fourth biggest empire in history, lasting over 250 years, but we remain largely ignorant about it here in the West. The Qing dynasty stretched from 1644 to the start of the 20th century. During this time, China experienced unprecedented wealth and stability, and cosmopolitan culture flourished, which means, luckily for us, craftsmanship thrived, and so did cartography. Our guest today on What's Your Map is a distinguished curator and historian whose work covers the art, politics, and history of East Asia. Richard Pegg is director and curator of Asian art at the MacLean Collection in Illinois. He's written widely on East Asian visual culture, from ritual bronzes to Chinese swords. Richard, thanks so much for joining us on What's Your Map? I'm sure you have something rather wonderful to show us today. Can you describe the maps that you've brought?
Thanks, Jerry. Yeah, for me, this is an exciting opportunity to talk about two maps in particular that I've spent quite a lot of time thinking about, researching, writing about. Both of them, two examples, can be found on the Oculi Mundi webpage. One is the Blue China World Map, and the other is the Blue China Celestial Map.
Richard, just give me a historical location for the production of this map and also the different editions that we have of it that survive.
So it's produced in the city of Suzhou, which is in the southwestern, close to the coast of China. So Suzhou is a major center of artistic production. So it's not specifically maps. There's book production, print production, paintings, literature. All of the arts have been centered in Suzhou since the beginning of the Ming Dynasty in the 14th century. The terrestrial map we've found 10 different editions at this point. The particular edition we're looking at here is what we call type F, or the sixth. This one is undated, and the bulk of them are undated, but are all after 1820. The celestial's a different matter. That's six editions. We actually only 2 weeks ago identified a sixth. Most of them are dated either 1822, as is the edition we'll look at, or 1826.
These are two extraordinary maps, Richard, a terrestrial and a celestial map, and they are beautifully blue. I mean, they're extraordinary. Let's start by, please tell me, why do we think they're blue?
They use Prussian blue, which had been sourced from Europe until the beginning of the 19th century, where it began to be locally produced in Canton. And so some of these maps actually use this locally produced Prussian blue.
And let's look a little bit at this production of these maps. They're printed in a very, very particular style, aren't they? A form of rubbing, which again, for a Western audience thinking about printing, is very, very different. Can you just explain how they're made?
So typically in printing, whether it's on a woodblock or copper plate or lithograph, a negative image is carved or etched into the block or plate. You ink the plate, and then you apply paper to it under pressure. You peel away the paper, And what you're left with is a positive image on the paper from a negative image on the block. In the rubbing printing method, which is developed very early in China, probably the Tang Dynasty, 8th century, the image is carved typically onto stone in a positive image. The paper is moistened and applied onto the stone, and then it is inked so that the ink is applied on top of the paper, which is on top of the substrate that supports it. What you wind up with is a positive image from a positive image. This is a very atypical for printing, even within China. And that's one of the things, again, that's unique about the production of these blue maps is instead of using stone, they're carving these into wood blocks. So these need to be very large wood blocks that are carved. The paper is applied onto the block, and then it is inked, in this case, using Prussian blue.
And it gives you this amazing impact, doesn't it? So the carved lines remain white and they then float in this field of just an incredible saturated blue. I mean, it's something, to a Western eye, this is something so completely different, which is created through different forms of technical production.
Indeed, and they are impressive. I mean, they're spectacular to see in person because they're also huge. They're more than 2 meters wide and a meter and a half tall. They're printed on 8 separate blocks. So you get 8 separate sheets that are then mounted in hanging scrolls, but they can also be mounted on screens, folding, sliding doors. They're exported very quickly after production to Japan and to multiple formats within different consumption practices that happen in Japan versus where they're produced in Suzhou in China.
Do you see the impact of Western technology, science, cartographic developments on these maps? Or is there a way in which the Chinese cartographic tradition is very much developing separately from those Western influences?
Everything about these two maps is not Western. So in complete contrast, the sort of the models, the typologies, completely independent, and we'll get to that in a moment. We'll sort of tease out what's specifically the interest of, for example, the terrestrial map and sort of the functionality of that in a within a Chinese context.
Let's do it. I mean, this is so fascinating. I'm looking at the blue China terrestrial map. It is such a beautiful object. Let's get into it, Richard, and set this up for me. Could you give me the title as well in the original? What are we seeing here with this map? What is it called?
So in Chinese, it's the Da Qing Yi Tong Wan Yan Di Li Quan Tu.
And how would that translate rather roughly for you?
So what you're looking at is 5 sets of binomial terms. So the first 2 characters is the Great Qing Empire. The next 2 is a wish or the aspirations of 10,000 years that may it be everlasting. The next is unified, the sense of something that's brought together in a single visual presence. The next 2 characters are kind of unique within titles, cartographic titles in China. The use of the term Di Li, which translates into something like geographical. And then the final 2 characters, Quan Tu, are complete map. So it's the complete map of the Qing Empire, the everlasting unified map of geological complete maps.
Now, talk me through the map. I'm looking at it here, and what I see broadly is my sense of China, the topography of China. But it is and it is not, as we would imagine in the West, an accurate topographical representation, is it? What are we looking at, Richard? Can you just sketch it out for me as I sit
Sure.
here and look at this?
So we're looking at something, a completely different notion of the empire. So it's not meant to be a world map per se. It's the Chinese or the Qing dynasty empire and the relationships it has with outside of China proper. And so you have sort of geophysical details, like the two major rivers, which you can see running horizontally. Mm-hmm. You've got the Yellow River to the north, the Yangtze River to the south, very bright white. You've got sort of ocean along the right side, along across the bottom, and in the top left corner, that little bit of ocean is actually the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. And so you actually have some toponyms there for some of the European countries. So Holland is there, Great Britain is there, Spain is there. And so you have this kind of framework. Above the Yellow River, you'll see this kind of looks like a river of dots. Yep. And that represents the Gobi Desert and the Taklamakan Deserts. Running parallel to that, if you look closely, is the Great Wall, which runs across, I think, five or six of the sheets. So you'll see the Yellow River, you'll see the Great Wall, you'll see the dots of the Gobi Desert above that. And so this is sort of the geophysical framework that everything else is suspended on.
And so take me through, what is it really, I guess, trying to show us? And I think also we've got these different, the dots and the squares, the way in which a certain use of geometry is telling us something
right.
different.
So there's a little introductory text panel. So the map is read from the right side to the left. Mm. So the first panel, the first sheet, there's a large text block there. Mm. In the midst of it, you'll see little shapes embedded. So there's a rectangle and a circle and a triangle and a square with a triangle on top. If you kind of blow that up and look into that detail, that's our key to administrative units. This is an administrative map. And so something that, a term that I've coined to describe these, I call them encoded toponyms.
Nice.
And so what happens is that shape, if you blow up any detail in the sort of central part of the map, you'll see nothing but toponyms, so place names, typically two characters, surrounded by a shape. And that tells you if it's a provincial capital, or it's a city, or it's a village, or it's a town. And so this notion of encoding the place name itself with a simple shape gives us the entire administrative body of the Qing Empire. What this tells us is, in a snapshot, your communication systems, your tax bases, your population densities, all of that information is embedded visually in a very simple process. In addition, you'll see, so that's sort of the inner core of China, and most of those encoded toponyms are in the center. And then you have this whole kind of periphery. And if you look next to, for example, the title, there's a text block.
Yeah.
That text block describes Korea. And so it's completely abstracted. It's about a relationship, an administrative relationship. So we have the inner workings, administration, and then the outer relationships. These are places and geopolitical entities that the Qing Empire has relationships with. So you see one for Korea. If you look along in the oceans, you'll see text blocks for places like Manila, which becomes a major important center for local trade. Along the bottom, you'll see a text block that's Vietnam. You'll see one for Thailand. You'll see one for India. You'll see a text block if you go all the way up to the top left, where you see that little corner of ocean. Mm-hmm. The next panel over at the very top is a text block. That's the text block for Russia. And so there are no borders, but this is not meant to give you what you kind of expect for a large map of this kind, that there's a kind of correct scale. This is a relational map. All of the place names are correct, east, west, north, south, but the distance between those dots, those place names, isn't to scale, but that's not of interest to this map. This is an administrative map.
So are the more foundational philosophical, mathematical and spatial ideals within Chinese culture which create this map and say, within a Chinese ideal, this is a version of what the territory is?
The kinds of information that are presented are infinitely more complex than the same mapping from a European perspective. You have none of the information about administration. You have no sense of, sometimes in sort of 19th into 20th century, the dot that you often see on a Western style map with its place name next to it might be bigger or smaller. And that might be an indication of some kind of population difference. The kind of information that's embedded in this visually, we don't have any equivalent in Western mapping traditions. This is extremely dense. You've aggregated all of these complex data sets into a very simple, easy to read visual presentation.
Can you say something about the orientation? Because I'm fascinated by how different cultures orientate their maps and what's at the top. And you know, in the West, we have the North at the top. And I'm intrigued that most Chinese maps like this tend to put North at the top as well. But I don't think that's necessarily because of the influence of Western maps, is it, Richard?
So in this case, yes, North is at the top. Whether there's a correlation between East and West in thinking about our place on the planet and sort of prioritizing one direction, certainly in English, we talk about North being up, which is just sort of a completely made up construct. Mm. The fact that North is on this particular map to the North, I would say it's more running in parallel rather than there being sort of a corollary relationship. That human beings and their relationship with the world around them, you want to quantify it, qualify it. And so there's sort of universal principles.
Which leads us rather nicely into the universal celestial realm of the next map that you're going to talk about, this other beautiful blue celestial map. I have seen a version of this on a wall. It is utterly staggering. I mean, if you walk past, you're just drawn somehow to this map. Tell me about this, Richard, and give me its title again and its historical context.
So the celestial map has, remember I talked about that these are pairs of characters, right? These are binomial terms. And so we have the same thing happening here. In this case, it says Huntian, Yitong, Xingxiang, Chuentu. So two of the terms, Yitong, unified, and the last two, Chuentu, are the same two terms. And this is, in the title to start, a linkage with the terrestrial map, so that you know that these are meant to be a pair. The title translates as something like Complete Chart of Celestial Equatorial Fixed Stars. The term Chuan Tu, the two character in Chinese, can be translated in a dozen ways. It's chart, map, drawing, picture, sketch, any one of these terms. I differentiate between these two, calling the terrestrial a map and the celestial a chart. But that's the Chinese, in fact, doesn't differentiate that term.
And what is it showing us, Richard?
So they're like the terrestrial map. There's a lot going on here. You've got, in this case, I want to talk about just the pure aesthetics. Mm. So what you will notice if you look at the overall is on the far right, the title in these very large ancient characters. This is what's called small seal script. You've got on the far left, if you go all the way to the left, a kind of cursive script. It's called Xingshu, or a kind of running script. And then the tiny characters that surround the planisphere are all what's known as standard script. And so the visual presentation of three different calligraphic styles has a very particular aesthetic and gives us a hint as to who is designing this map. It's quite unusual to see three completely different calligraphic styles in a single presentation. in terms of what you're looking at, overall, you've got this planisphere, this celestial chart, that's embedded in a text body. And this is not accidental. This idea of the circle in the square is a very early Chinese concept of the cosmos, that heaven and earth embedded in each other and that relationship between the two. So it's a visual cue again to this kind of very Chinese consideration of space, of heaven and earth together.
It's fascinating to hear Richard explain how to read and understand these two gorgeous blue China maps. But before we hear more about them, I'd love for you to join our global community of explorers by subscribing to this podcast. From mapping the cosmos to journeying to the North Pole, we have a wealth of episodes for you to enjoy. And subscribing means you won't miss a single new map, guest, or story from this series, or the next. Now, back to Richard and his deep blue knowledge. What I'm trying to understand is, because I don't quite get how it's based on an earlier engraving, I understand. So it goes right back to 1247. It goes back to an earlier engraved celestial depiction of astronomical knowledge, 700 years nearly earlier. Just explain what's going on here, Richard.
So I mentioned that the production place is the city of Suzhou. Hmm. So in Suzhou, there are two steles, these stone slabs, vertical stone slabs. One has a terrestrial map. The other has a celestial map. The terrestrial map is known as the Dili 2, the Dili map. The same two Dili characters that are in the title of our blue map. The celestial map is called Tianwen 2. And this is something like heavenly signs or heavenly writing as a kind of literal translation. Those two steles, which were in fact erected in the 13th century, still stand today. And so if we think about the makers of this, that these are people who collect rubbings in the city of Suzhou, in this city, these two stelae, they stand today in the Confucian Temple, still there, are local historical documents that depict the empire. And this is understood from an imperial level. So in that case, the original 13th century ones were made for the emperor. And they represent his legitimacy to rule heaven. He's the arbiter between heaven and earth. And that's what these two things are about, a map of the earth and the map of heaven. And his position between those two and his legitimacy to rule are made manifest in those two maps. So the makers are referencing specifically their city, two objects that are meant to be together. And this is a moment that sort of separates from European traditions. Ptolemy separates his geography, his celestial map, and his terrestrial map, and the purposes of celestial mapping in historical Europe and historical China are completely different.
That is hard to get our heads around. So that sense in which what you're seeing here is not an embrace of a geocentric, you know, Greco-Roman conception of the cosmos. It's a much more political understanding of the connection between the heavens above and the earth below. There's something very political and imperial about that.
Exactly. When we look at a European celestial map, what you're looking at, so if you live in the Northern Hemisphere, the stars that you can see are the same. When you look at this map, it's virtually unreadable, except in the very central core, you'll see the Big Dipper. And so that's universal. Everyone recognizes the Big Dipper because it's, so that inner circle is the ring of constant visibility. In the Northern Hemisphere, those constellations are always on view 365 days a year. The Big Dipper, within a Chinese context, whether you're conscious of it or not, the Big Dipper appears, so the handle of the Big Dipper appears to turn 1 degree every day. So the Big Dipper is used as a way for charting the sky at night. So it's a very important constellation in a Chinese context. All of the Chinese constellations, or asterisms as they're known, all those lines that connect to their vision of the sky are all related to the human terrestrial imperial realm. In the center are the emperor and the people around him. All the bureaucracy of the administration is depicted in all those different constellations. And so when things, anomalies, happen, a supernova, an eclipse, a meteor, something travels through a particular part of the sky, there's a correlation with what's happening in the heavens, with what's happening on the earth. And so these star charts are very much about that relationship between heaven and earth.
Fascinating, because then you've got this concept, is this right, Richard, of the mandate of heaven? The emperor's yes. legitimacy rests on this concept, the mandate of heaven, which is what drives this kind of map in relation to the more terrestrial map. What is that phrase, mandate of heaven? It's such a wonderful evocative conception. I want to have the mandate of heaven.
The authority of the emperor is bestowed from heaven. And so this mandate is given to him. And part of his legitimacy is, in fact, that he does act as arbiter between heaven and earth. And he has people who, in the court, look at these charts, these astrological charts, and understand that there are these relationships.
So there's a little connection there. I'm curious, as you describe that, that there's this European tradition where you have printed terrestrial and celestial globes, and they're paired. And there's a way in which it may have a different representation of the heavens, but there's something about an emperor. You have, you know, the Habsburg Emperor Charles V saying, I'm kind of in charge of both of these spaces. Is that an analogy which is something a bit like what we're seeing here? And I mean, not completely. I don't want to just collapse the two. But is there something there?
I would say very much so. And what's interesting about that is you're very right that the very earliest, maybe 100, 150 years of globe making, they were made as pairs, as sets. And it's very interesting that as we get sort of into the age of reason, empirical methodology of late 18th into the 19th century, that no longer are globes made as pairs. In the case of China, that separation didn't happen.
Let's talk about a bit of your life and work, and also I'm intrigued at the encounter with the blue map. So, Richard, how did you first encounter these blue maps?
So in my role as a curator, we purchased for the MacLean collection where I work, I purchased one in 2007. And it wasn't for another 7 or 8 years that I hadn't really thought about it. I did this book about 10 years ago on East Asian mapping, and I wanted to include it. And there was literally nothing in Chinese, in any language, about these blue maps. And so I became sort of intrigued about it. It wasn't until 4 or 5 years later that I even knew that there was a celestial map that went with it. Then I had a map fellow come. She's my co-author for a book that we've just produced, Elka Papalitsky. She came as a fellow, and she started noticing differences between the versions that she could find online. And at that time, there were a half a dozen, maybe it was 4 or 5. And so a year later, she and I decided to sort of launch and write a book. So I've sort of taken a very deep dive into it at this point.
Tell me about the MacLean collection where you work.
MacLean collection is, we think, the largest private collection of maps in the world, all mediums, formats. We've cataloged about 43,000 maps and cartographic objects, from globes to pocket maps to atlases to sheet maps to wall maps to ephemera with maps on them. Mr. McLean began collecting in the 1960s and has put together really something quite remarkable.
And I'm interested in your role within the collection because you're really coming out of a tradition more around visual culture and art history. So I wonder, what does that give you when you're looking at maps and map making? I come from a literary tradition. So many of us, as we both know, Richard, so many people who work on maps aren't trained as geographers or specific, there is no field of map history. We all come often from different places. What is it particularly that has shifted for you over time from your initial training to being so engaged with maps?
So I started with literature of East Asia.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Good.
Yes.
Another literary person.
So classical Chinese, Japanese, and Korean literature. That led me into art history degree, East Asian art history. I had been working in a museum context. So Mr. McLean hired me 21 years ago to run his Asian art museum. And to install it, and he built a purpose-built museum. And so it was about 8 or 9 years into that the map collection moved sites. And the map curator came to me with all of these maps that he couldn't read, that they were in Chinese, Japanese, and Korean. I started to look into East Asian maps. There's no sort of person who's taken an overview. There's work on Chinese maps, Japanese maps, Korean maps, but no kind of overview. And so this first book I did, Cartographic Traditions of East Asian Maps, is still the only book extant on the topic. What my background brings to this, for example, a map like this, I was immediately interested in the color and the production model. And so my art historical background, I wanted to know how it was printed, who was printing it, what were the models. These are not typically the kinds of deep dives that cartographic studies go into. And one of the reasons that there's this sort of excitement about my book that's coming out is that I'm bringing in this kind of new approach.
Richard, you've introduced these two beautiful maps, not just for their color, but their content, and you've taken us on an amazing journey into their heart. And I'm just slightly blown away by what we've done in this conversation. So I just want to thank you so much. I mean, I think the work is fantastic, and it's been a pleasure talking to you on What's Your Map. Thank you so much, Richard Pegg.
Thank you, Jerry. This has been fun for me, and I'm always happy to talk about the blue maps.
After the interview, Richard showed me his shoes, which are covered in the blue China terrestrial map. He's definitely someone who is head-to-toe obsessed, and rightly so. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland collection and send suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com.